Yeah, thank you very much for being here. And the topic of mantras is really a very, it's a broad topic because there are many mantras. Vedic literature is the source of where we get our mantras from. Vedas are very different mantras, and obviously not all for the same purpose. But the idea is that mantras have an influence especially on our consciousness, and sometimes also on the environment. A mantra is basically its sound. So we're dealing with sound. The Vedic idea is that it works with the classical model of the elements, such as earth, water, fire, air, ether, as the gross material elements. And it is said that sound belongs to the most subtle one. These elements from earth to ether are going from gross to more subtle. Earth being the most gross, ether being more subtle. So it is said that that sound is manifest in all of them. That sound. So also in the ether, sound would be manifest. Well, okay, that's in line with modern thinking. So therefore it is said that of all the energies that one may apply, sound is the most subtle. You know? For example, it's said in air, there is sound is present, touch is present, but no form is present. When we come to fire, sound, touch is present, and form is present. When it comes to water, you get taste. So you get sound, taste, form. And then when it comes to earth, smell is added. So it is said of all the material influence of sound is the most subtle. It's said, therefore, sound is the closest to the subtle body. You know, in the Vedic literature, they define the subtle body as mind, intelligence, and false ego. You know, false ego means then our identification as the self. It's as the self, as an identity here. So Vedic literature makes that distinction. So it says sound has a direct influence on consciousness. It can false ego or identification is the result of being attached or entering into relationships with matter. For example, you can say one is born in Australia and therefore you can speak Australian in an Australian way. Everything is Australian. Born in another country, another mood, another mentality. So due to no other reason than that you are accustomed to it and that you become attached to it. Anywhere else in the world they say Gadai, they look at you like what's going on. Because here it's the most normal thing in the world. And one gets accustomed and gradually it becomes part of our identity. So many things become part of our identity. Our clothes, particular dressing style, hair, whatever. The glasses I wear, that's me. And these sort of half-rimmed glasses. Like that, we develop our identity. And it's not only external, it enters into our consciousness and begins to condition our consciousness in a subtle way. Education contributes to it, because we know very well that an educational institution is not just aimed at transferring knowledge. There is something else going on. It is about a particular way to think. One is trained to think in a different way, and that's like practically speaking, maybe the most essential element is like, okay, as we call a critical way of thinking in modern educational system. Fine, so a PhD is not just about cramming knowledge, but it's almost like an initiation where you like go into a totally different state of mind, a transformation, and successfully changed for life, never the same, PhD. Alright, so that's all like part of how the consciousness becomes conditioned by culture and by training, by external influences. So this is what Vedic literature calls not our true self, our like inherent being, but sort of the being that is transposed upon that original being, an external identity. So Vedic literature is stating that a person should return to his true self, to the original self. Mantra is then a means to reconnect with our true self. And that, the true self in Sanskrit is referred to as Atma, and the word Atma, which translates literally as self, also translates as body, also translates as mind, and translates as soul. So the point is that there are different concepts of the self. Some are thinking, okay, my body, yes, this is me. Others thinking, no, it's my, it's the way I think. That's where my identity is. That's my real self. And again, others who take it to a spiritual platform are looking as the soul, as the self. For example, some doctors make the point that they see, of course, in the hospital, one is confronted with birth and death every day, and life coming into being and life ending. And they say that when a life ends, that something is immediately a distinct change. And although everything is still there, such a distinct change that it really appears that something is leaving. Well, that's in line with Eastern thinking, where the idea is that at the time of death, the soul is leaving the body. It's the soul being the spark of life, being the spark of consciousness, exits the body and is then looking down upon that body and is, as such, not able to enter into that body, still perceiving and clearly existing separate from the body. So they said that when we are involved, when a living being is involved, with trying to enter into relationships with matter, then gradually the ability of the consciousness also becomes limited. So through mantra, we rise above matter, we reconnect with our original identity as a spiritual entity, and then through mantra, we also realize that we are not alone. Just as here in this world, we always exist in relationship with our environment. Although we are each individual entities, no one is just an individual by himself. In quantum mechanics, we are not looking at an object in itself, but we're looking at an object in relationship to its environment and how the environment is influencing that particular object. Well, the same is there for us, right? Because I'm a different person at home, right? Like surrounded by friends and family, than I'm like in a room with strangers. Or, you know, I'm a different person with my friends and in a group that may be an antagonistic attitude towards me. You can see the consciousness changes. So we are different in relationship, and different relationships bring things out of us. And are we with loved ones, it brings whole side out of us that we didn't even know we had. So that is how in this world, in relationships, we grow and are experiencing different aspects of ourselves. Yes. So, just when we go to the original identity, the identity of the soul, that identity of the soul is also existing in relationship. Not existing like a separate unit. Also on that level, we are all always in a relationship. But then the soul, therefore, in Vedic literature is described as being in a marginal position, Sanskrit called tatastha, or in between. It's said it's in between the Bahirani Shakti, the external energy, which is matter consisting of earth, water, fire, air, ether, and so on, and the Antaranga Shakti, the internal energy. So it said that the mantras are lifting us up and reconnecting us with the internal energy, freeing us from temporary identification that we picked up in associating with matter, and bringing us back to our original self, whatever that may be. Then as we are beginning to discover our original self, there's also an identity. But that is our fundamental nature that then begins to re-emerge. And the result is that we feel we become peaceful, we become satisfied, we become free from anxiety. As long as we are in an external role, there is anxiety. So even this world, there's always anxiety. We are in a university, there's anxiety connected to it because you're supposed to live up to a role. Everyone is trying to fit in. And to some extent we do, to some extent we don't, and we hope that we can cut a convincing profile. And so life is a lot about a convincing profile, and then And he hoped you're not going to be exposed. Because sometimes, we fall short of the model. The mantra brings us away from any artificial profile and roots us in our true self. And in that way, one becomes totally relaxed. That's on a personal level. Therefore, on a social level, gradually, the mantra frees us from any facade and facilitates us entering into real relationships. And then on a cosmic level, the mantra reconnects us with the spiritual origin of everything, we in our tradition are referring to as the all-attractive. The all-attractive, I was just yesterday remembering that book plus DVD, The Secret. I think everybody sort of noticed it. And the secret was The Law of Attraction. That was an American production, and I remember this loud American voice saying, "Yes, ever since I discovered the Law of Attraction, my salary doubled." Yeah, it doubled. Yeah. Of course, in America, it was translated into dollars and cents, whatever it might be. It was interesting. It was a very commercial approach. But it was about the law of attraction. And it was all about what we can attract. But actually, there is a law of attraction, but it's the other way around. We are, when we try to be an attractor and attract many things, we will struggle. But when we allow ourselves to become attracted, right, at that stage we realize that higher identity. So we are trying to reconnect with the all-attractive. In Sanskrit, the word for all-attractive, the all-attractive, is Krishna. But actually, when we will be chanting the mantra, we'll be focusing on that mantra, and the word Krishna in that mantra, it means the all-attractive. There are many things that are attractive, but think about it. What is all-attractive? Not so simple. Not simple at all. But exactly, there is that hankering for something attractive. The other day, I was in a discussion on various arguments for a possible existence of God, and then one of the arguments is a psychological argument. It's basically based on needs and the concept of needs. Like whenever we have a need, then on all levels we find an answer to that need. For example, there's thirst, and lo and behold, there was water. Food, hunger, food, like that. So then Nietzsche mentions that somehow or other man, to feel more comfortable, had to create God. Pascal mentions that if there was no God, there certainly would be a need to invent him. So there is a recognition by various philosophers about an inherent spiritual need. If it's not filled with God in a traditional culture, then maybe it is filled in a more modern culture with something like a cosmic consciousness, but basically again a spiritual need. So the spiritual need has been re-emerging in the world again and again in different cultures, and also in our modern day culture it exists in some form or another. The essence of spirituality is the all-attractive. The essence of what in traditional cultures is called God is the all-attractive. It is that where one enters into a higher state of consciousness and experience. Then we tap into unknown potential. So the mantra will do that, and we're going to embark on it in a matter of minutes. So practically, mantra chanting is simple. It is easy to do. It can be done very quietly, all by oneself, early in the morning, before the world wakes up, is a great time. When the roads are empty and only the birds are sitting on the street, at that time is a time when, according to the Vedas, the muhurtas, or the hours, are in goodness. The Brahma muhurta. The Brahma muhurta is a time predominated by goodness. Now, in the middle of the day, passion has kicked in, and the atmosphere is already predominated by passion. Tonight, after midnight, that's when the influence of ignorance becomes prevalent. That's why, I'm speaking in general now, but that's why for a lot of people it's more natural to have a drink at night than to have one early in the morning. Of course, some people can have a drink any time of the day. That's another story. But you see, the night is that hour. The morning, the perfect hour for meditation. So in the morning one can softly speak the mantra. But today in our meditation we'll add music. Music is known as raga in India, and sometimes as rock in the West. And now I admit I'm from the 60s and 70s. That's when I used to play electric guitar, and I shifted to raga. But sometimes it turns into rock. Don't hold it against me. It's called fusion. Mantra fusion. It does happen. So raga is... There are many ragas. It is said that every living being has its own raga, his own sound. Yes. But then there are 16,108 ragas that are supposed to be spiritual. So, some of these melodies are also bringing out a certain mood. So in this way, music as a vehicle for the meditation. And that's what we'll try. So the idea is, There's a choir, that's you guys. You're the choir, and then there's one who sings first, and, well, with the microphone. That's my turn. So I'll try and produce a melody, and then the choir just repeats it as good as possible, and that way slowly our meditation will build up. I'll try and start a little simple, somewhere midway, I may go a little creative and the whatever, see where it takes us. Some of you have chanted before, so if you've never done it, don't worry. You can softly follow the more experienced one. But after a little while, just let it go and just sing, because it's not a concert, you know. We can turn it into a concert where I sing and at the end you give an applause and fine. But that's not mantra meditation. Mantra meditation is where we share an experience. I don't know where it's going to take us. I don't know what it's going to do with us. Let's find out what the mantra will do for us as an experience. All right, it's like, that was my explanation. Oh, it was of some interest to you. All based on Vedic texts. So we are going to awaken a spiritual experience. Maybe not instant, in 5 minutes, but something, maybe, that we can set things up and see where it goes. Start slow and then we'll build up this. Thank you.
I'd like to give a round of applause to Pranam Bhagwan. Deeper perspective on mantra meditation. So now, as you mentioned, we'll be doing some mantra meditation. Usually we sit down on the floor traditionally, so maybe all of you can stand up and push these chairs towards the side, and some of us will be taking these chairs out. So for the first 15 minutes, we'll sit down, and we have